Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I am your host, Phil Liskov. It is just me today, but not just me, of course. I have Matthew D'Ambrosio is back on the podcast, past and future guest, TV writer on The Witcher, a social media guru. Can we say that? I mean, you're better on Twitter than I am.
You can say whatever you want. It doesn't make it true.
We have a president, sort of, right now, who believes that to be true as well. But we are going to be talking about one of my favorite bands and one of Matthew's favorite bands. We're going to be talking about the Smashing Pumpkins today. And the reason we're talking about them is because 1999 was a sort of the beginning of the end for this band, I think we can all safely say. You know, they and we'll talk about this as we sort of get into the chronology of this band a little bit, but we're going to talk a little bit specifically about Everlasting Gaze, which was the first single off, as far as I'm concerned, their last real album. And it came out in 99, and we'll talk about that. We'll unpack the video and the single and all of that. But let's rewind a little bit, Matthew. And how did the Smashing Pumpkins come into your life? And what do they mean to you?
I think for me, it was around the time that, because it was like the mid-90s was when, you know, the Today music video, Disarm. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, that's when music videos were like the big thing. And so I remember seeing the music video for Bullet with Butterfly Wings and just thinking of like, oh, you know, despite all my rage, I am still just a rat in a cage. And so it's just like, there was just something about it. Like, you know, I was just so into that song for a long time. And then obviously Melancholy, the album. And so that was sort of my, you know, music videos were my introduction to most music when I was a kid. But Smashing Pumpkins were like the first band that where I was like, oh, this is like music that I actually want to listen to all the time. And I did.
So you're a little younger than me, if I'm not mistaken, I believe. I am currently 40, so I don't want to say how old you are. But
I'm 21 years old, yes.
So you're a lot younger than I am. Uh-huh. But it's interesting because, and I want to unpack this a little bit, because I actually think that they are, I think they were a little bit of a guilty pleasure for a lot of people. You know, they come out at a time, I mean, they start to peak, obviously, during grunge. And in a weird way, I'm not sure that they're totally a grunge band. Like, they are in the sense that they've got an axe to grind and there's a lot of, like, emo components to it, for sure. But there's a florid quality to them. There's a theatricality to them. And a kind of, if I can be honest, a bit of a drama student component to them. That
very dramatic.
That don't make them feel like Nirvana or Pearl Jam or Soundgarden or all these bands, which is what, quite frankly, made me gravitate towards them. I don't know if you felt the same way.
Yeah, well, I remember the first time I got Melancholy, I was so drawn to like the double CD because it was huge, and it was so cool because it was like a little bit of everything, which I think at the time was like a huge criticism of the album, was like it's all over the place. But for me, I was like, oh, this is like hard rock, this is like pop rock, this is indie rock, all on one double album. And so that's what appealed to me about them. Cause like, depending on whatever mood I'm in, if I want like languid 9-minute, you know, rock opera, I have Porcelina of the Vast Oceans. Or if I want like, you know, just to get mad at my dad, right, I have Zero. And so it's just like it runs the gamut.
Yeah.
And that's, one of the things that appealed me about them.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it feels like they, I mean, obviously Billy Corgan is the main voice of this band, literally, figuratively, and in every sort of way. And it does feel as though they had their moment for sure, but he still doesn't feel satisfied by what transpired over the history of this band, Longevity in music is kind of an impossibility. There are a handful of bands that somehow found a way to continue being relevant, but sometimes you have your moment and you have to seize it and you have to enjoy it for what it is. And it does feel like this band sort of, in the research that I've done and in just, you know, being a fan of them, it feels like they never really got along. They never really enjoyed making this music. And I would argue they certainly didn't seem to enjoy performing it either. So there's just like this weirdness, this dissonance in
and
them.
And it's funny. Because also the common denominator in all of that is Billy Corgan. Because like, I also got really into Zwan. Remember Zwan?
Sure. I do remember
Zwan. And again, it was like, and I like that their only album a lot. But like, they fell apart because they all hated each other in a very similar way like that happened with Smashing Pumpkins. And so for me, I'm like, oh, I think it's probably just like Billy Corgan, which is like totally cool. Yeah. I get it. But at the same time, it's just like, what's the saying of like, if everyone you like you meet in your day is an asshole, like maybe you're the asshole.
Maybe they're the asshole. Yeah. I mean, there's you know, it's funny. It does feel like I mean, I guess heavy is the head that wears the crown, but there's a little bit of this like component of a guy who just wasn't really built for this, like for stardom, for being the front man of a rock band. Like, despite the fact that it's perhaps what he wanted most, he just wasn't actually emotionally built for it, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. You
know, it's one of those things where I don't know. So you said the first song that you remember was seeing the video for Today, right? That was one of the first moments.
It was like the ice cream truck, right?
Yes, yeah.
I remember seeing it from Beavis and Butthead. It was like, because Beavis and Butthead used to play music videos. And I remember seeing that and like seeing the music video and then hearing Beavis and Butthead talking over it, being like, I wish they would shut up because the song is really good.
Yeah, Beavis and Butthead were kind of Mystery Science Theater, you know, whatever, or that. Like they, in the beginning, they were kind of taking the piss out of music videos, which is fair.
Sure.
You know, the first time, so I heard them in, the first time I heard them was the single soundtrack. Drown was the last song on the single soundtrack. And that song comes out in, that soundtrack comes out in 92. Gish comes out in 91 to some acclaim and fanfare, but is quickly kind of eclipsed by Nevermind, which comes out in September of 91, which kind of changes the whole game, right? Mm-hmm. They're on this very, very successful soundtrack for singles, which arguably is more successful than the movie ever was. And it's sort of a moment for them. And it's clear, at least, that Billy Corgan realizes that like this is their moment, as does Virgin, like Virgin, the record label, like this is our band. We're all in on Smashing Pumpkins, despite the fact that their name is immensely stupid. We're all in on this band. And he sort of, I mean, I guess he was in a depression. It seems like he was in a depression for a good chunk of his creative output, but
his whole career,
his whole career. Yeah. He has this moment apparently where he pulls himself out of this depression that he's in, and the lyrics of Today come to him, and sort of Siamese Dream kind of comes to him in this wash of creativity post post-depression, which is a fantastic way to deal with depression, and I'm glad he was able to cathartically work his way through that. But that song has sort of this, and I'm sure you know this as well, but like, you know, there's rumors that he was suicidal and that this was the song that like got him out of his suicidal downturn, whatever you want to call it, downward spiral. It's just a great fucking song. Like I don't want to take too much. I don't want to put too much on it because it takes almost away from the song.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like the lyrics are like pink ribbon scars that never forget. You know, and it's like, oh, okay. Like again, it's like the kind of stuff I would write on my notebooks when I was in high school. But like, I mean, and I'm not even joking. I did that shit. I absolutely did that shit. I had the Zero shirt. Mm-hmm. That like I wore almost like every day until it literally fell apart in the washing machine. Like it disintegrated because like the fabric just melted away. I swear to God, I put it in the washing machine and it came out in tatters because That's like I just really wore sad. It. So I wore it so much. It was my favorite shirt.
I recently bought the SP in the silver heart. I have that on a black shirt that I'm that I quite enjoy. Mm-hmm. I had many, many Smashing Pumpkins shirts as a kid. I think that it kind of comes back to what you were saying a little bit earlier, which is that they threaded a bunch of needles in terms of genre. They didn't really kind of fit into one genre. So I felt like I was kind of checking a lot of boxes as a fan, right? Because I wasn't, if I'm being completely frank, I liked Nirvana, but I wasn't like into Nirvana. I didn't feel like they spoke to me in the same way that I guess a lot of people felt like they spoke to them. I think the theatricality and the, you know, this sort of almost whimsical, if I could be so bold as to put that on the Smashing Pumpkins, that's kind of the stuff that I gravitated towards.
Yeah.
But Siamese Dream comes out in 93. It's huge, debuts 10 on the Billboard 200, sells over 4 million copies in the US, and it's obviously a big hit, it's a big success. And it's a great fucking album.
It's my favorite.
Is it your favorite of theirs?
Siamese Dream, absolutely.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. All right. I mean, I love it. I think there's something also about his output, and by his I mean Billy, every album that he put out could have been a double album, and in most situations he wanted it to be, and
yeah,
they'd constantly be like, no, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. Siamese Dream comes out, and then Pisces, how the fuck,
Iscariot,
sure,
yeah,
comes out the next year, which is all the B-sides off of Siamese Dream. Those two together also would have been just a tremendous album in and of itself. And that's the song that I love off of Pisces is Landslide, their cover of the Fleetwood Mac song. It's a beautiful cover.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of like, you're really seeing an ascension at this point. You know, this is mid 90s. This is on the crest of 90s sort of alternative rock and what have you. But Kurt Cobain dies in 94, if I'm not mistaken. Am I crazy, or is that, am I making that up? Hold on.
Actually know off the top of my head.
I want to make sure that I'm not talking shit. Yeah. Okay. So he dies in April of 94. And it leaves a big sort of vacuum of who's going to be the next Kurt Cobain. And it does feel like Melancholy comes out in 95, about a year or so after that. And they kind of felt like they were perhaps the band that was going to, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
but I don't know how you felt about them.
It felt like they were being positioned that way. And it's like another reason I feel that way is because they were showing up on stuff. Like, I remember that, like, one of my favorite episodes of The Simpsons is the Homer Palooza episode.
Yes.
Where it's like, you know, Homer introduces, or Billy Corgan introduces himself to Homer. Is like, Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins, Homer Simpson, smiling politely. You know, the original, they wanted to get Courtney Love for that really? Episode, but they couldn't get her. And the original joke was Courtney Love, and then Homer would reply, Homer happy. Was the original joke.
That's a great joke.
Yeah. But again, it was like, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins were showing up in the content that I was watching. And for me, that made him a household name, because I was like, oh, he's like on The Simpsons. This is so cool. Cypress Hill is also in this, but I don't really know who they are. You know, it's like, yeah, it like that sort of what's the word? I don't know. Just made him feel like bigger than life to me. Like he was on The Simpsons. I was like, this is so cool.
It also made them feel like, kind of, I don't want to say approachable because that's the wrong word, but it brought them into your home in a different way. It kind of rounded the edges off of them as well, which I think is, you know, a double-edged sword. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I think at that time, you know, being cool, and I guess maybe it still is, in the music scene, it's so important that you seem fucking cool. And then you're on The Simpsons, some people might argue, might make you less cool depending on who you are.
Yeah, or like make you even more cool because sure, you're on The Simpsons.
Sure. But basically, so, you know, Kurt Cobain dies in April of 94. October 95, Melancholy comes out. Billy Corgan writes 56 songs when he goes into the studio for this album, which he described as the wall for Generation X, which seems apropos, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a double album lasting over 2 hours. The songs were apparently intended to hang together conceptually as a symbol of the cycle of life and death, praised by Time as the group's most ambitious and accomplished work yet. It's certified 10 times platinum in the US, becoming the best-selling double album of the decade. Garners a whole bunch of Grammy awards. It has 5 singles: Bullet with Butterfly Wings, 1979, Zero, Tonight Tonight, and 33. Of which the first 3 were certified gold, all but 0 entered the top 40. I remember, I guess it's probably, you know, it's the summer. Okay, so I went to summer camp. And when you go to summer camp, basically you're kind of shut out from the world outside, right? So you don't really know what the fuck is going on. I remember a friend of mine picked me up at the after the summer camp to drive me home. And he was like, oh, I heard the new Smashing Pumpkins single, which, like, you know, blew my mind. Cause I was like, I didn't know they had a new song. I was 15. I mean, whatever. And I was like, oh, like, what is it? What's it about? He's like, I don't know what it's called, but it's something about vampires. And I was like, yeah, no, that tracks. Yeah. I mean, so you mentioned Bullet with Butterfly Wings was a big song for you. Yep. What was it about the song that spoke to you?
I think it was just the energy of it. Also being like an angsty, like, I mean, I can't even remember how old I was. I'm not good at math, so I'm not going to try it. But at that, you know, that young, early teen age, hearing people talking about their rage was relatable to me, especially as like, you know, a white suburban kid with nothing else to worry about, where it's like, you know, it's like my life was pretty great, but of course I'm like angsty for some reason. And it's like Smashing Pumpkins filled that void for me in a big way.
I mean, even their name, which is in and of itself this sort of, you know, rageful thing. You know, it's funny. We're going to do our top 10 songs for at the end for our listeners. But, you know, the angsty, angry Zero Bullet with Butterfly Wings version of Smashing Pumpkins is not my version of Smashing Pumpkins. I gravitate far more to the fantastical, the more ballad oriented stuff, the stuff that feels larger than life.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, where it's like, even though that was my intro, that's not on my top 10 list, that song.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, it's certainly not on mine. Although I will say that I just recently developed a pilot, and there's a specific needle drop to Bullet with Butterfly Wings where the beginning of that song, which is obviously spoken word of the world is a vampire, featured prominently in that pilot. So there you go. you know, take that for what it's worth. Yeah. So then basically, they release this album and then they quickly release The Aeroplane Flies High, which is a box set of all of the B-sides, which is in and of itself another double album of songs. Mm-hmm. So that comes out. And I would argue, I'm sure you would feel the same way, this is them at the peak of their powers, right? This is them being the biggest band that they'll ever be. It's an enormous album. They are touring it nonstop. July 11th, 96, in the middle of this tour, Jonathan Melvoin and Jimmy Chamberlain are caught. Well, Jonathan Melvoin dies of an overdose of heroin. Chamberlain is caught in possession of heroin. A few days later, the band announces that Chamberlain's been fired from the band. This is where sort of the rubber meets the road. And this is when the band, this is the descent now. Now we're seeing sort of a band, unsure of itself from this kind of point on. Mm-hmm. It does feel like Billy's relationship with Jimmy was sort of kind of the spine of this band, for good or for bad. Not to take anything away from James Iha and Darcy Retzky, the lead guitarist and bassist, but it feels like that.
Well, because also it felt like Billy bragged a lot during Siamese Dream of, like, he played every instrument except the drums, like, on the album. So it's like, you know, he played all of James and Darcy's roles anyway, just not live. And so I feel like the only thing he didn't play was the drums. And that to me spoke volumes of, like, well, that's why Jimmy Chamberlain was most important, I guess.
Because I can't do what he does.
Yeah. Even though for me, as like a young gay boy, I had such a crush on James Iha. With like that stripe in his hair, I was like, yes.
With this Pepe Le Pew gray streak.
Yeah, this is like doing something for me for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, I really believe that, and you'll see it in one of my picks for one of my favorite songs, that James and Darcy don't get nearly enough love. Now, they might not necessarily be, and who knows, writing, performing, this, that, whatever. There's a presence to the band as well. I mean, I think it should be said that there's a diversity in them, mm-hmm. in sort of what they bring aesthetically and culturally to this band, which I think is also an important component that people, I think, gloss over. It's a bummer that heroin sucks, drugs are stupid, and it's a shame that this, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what else to say other than that. It's just a shame that we didn't get 20 more albums out of them at sort of the peak of their powers.
Well, in a way, we kind of did with all the B-sides, like, and alternate takes of songs.
That's actually a really good point. It's I don't know. I own that beautiful vinyl that they have of Melancholy, and I have the vinyl of Adore and Siamese Dream as well. But the deluxe sort of super editions online that have like literally 30 more songs on them, and you're just like, there is an embarrassment of riches when it comes to Billy Corgan's output, for sure.
Because I remember, I didn't get Aeroplane Flies High until high school. I got on eBay. Because I didn't get it at the time. And I remember just like being like, holy shit, there is so many songs on this that I've just never heard. You know, like obviously, and like even Aeroplane Flies High, another song that I really love a lot. It was just, you know, what other bands really like had that, you know?
Yeah, I think you probably had a similar feeling to me when I bought it, which was, holy shit. Like it is a treasure trove of just mm-hmm. like, you know, if you loved them at that moment, they just handed you, you know, something in the vicinity of 25 new songs, all of which were, you know, almost as good, if not some of them better than the stuff that ended up on Melancholy.
Yeah.
So basically the band gives interviews saying that Melancholy would be the last quote unquote conventional Pumpkins record, and that rock had become stale. James Iha says the future is electronic music. It seems boring just to play rock music now.
Cool.
I mean, he wasn't necessarily wrong. I mean, but electronic music it's a different mode. And as we see, they do a song called I, which is on the Lost Highway soundtrack, which is a great fucking song. Yeah. And it becomes clear that like drum machines and electronic music is where they're going to go, if for no other reason, because Jimmy Chamberlain is in.
They don't have a drummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I love Adore, and I think it's like, it's a very underrated album of theirs, but I think it's so different than what came before that at the time, I think I was very disappointed in it because I was so into Melancholy, and then going to Adore, I was like, well, this is completely different. But I think over time I've like come to appreciate that about it. You know,
I think it's an album that in hindsight, a lot of people respect a lot more than they did at the time. Yeah. I think that Billy's hand was forced with obviously the Jimmy Chamberlain of it all. And it forced him to make a creative decision to alter the course of the band at the worst possible time. Like, yeah. I think that, you know, if Adore comes four or five albums down the road after they've followed up Melancholy three or four times over, perhaps people are like, okay, sure. But right at that moment when Britney Spears is blowing up and like all, you know, pop is just taking yeah. over the airwaves. And then you put out this kind of deeply esoteric, very sort of sad album about
goth.
Divorce.
I mean,
and
it's like goth rock. Yeah.
Yeah. I was listening to it, as I'm sure you have been listening to a lot of Smashing Pumpkins over the past week or so. The production of Adore is really beautiful. I mean, Billy produced the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's really lush. And the aesthetic that went with it, which was full on like emo goth, sepia tone. Everyone's wearing black with black eyeliner. And it's basically his Cure album, if we're being honest. But I quite like it. But that comes out.
It doesn't do well.
Is all I was going to say. No one really gave a shit about it. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's the thing too. Like you were saying, of like coming after Melancholy and all of like the big rock pop singles going into like Ava Adore as like that next single is very different in tone than what came before it. But the music video for Ava Adore, I think, is so cool and is so beautiful, and it was like, I think I was able to forgive, not forgive, because maybe that's not the right word. I think I was more willing to embrace whatever they had coming because like that music video was so cool. And like, you know, I trusted them at the time, and I still will for the next couple albums of theirs.
Yeah. I remember it was a long gestation period as well, which it's ironic that like 3 years felt like a long time for an album to come out back in the '90s, but it was right. Yeah. The turnaround of albums was just much, much faster. Now, you know, it takes a couple years and that's what it is. But so it takes 3 years for Adore to come out, and I'm just, you know, obviously chomping at the bit, just can't fucking wait for it to come out. And similar to yourself, found myself, looking for something that wasn't there and thus was a little bit disappointed, I think, at the time. You know, Perfect is kind of a sequel to 1979, which is, and it's a fine single, and it literally, the video is a sequel to the sequel to the first song, to 1979. So it kind of, there's a harmony to it a little bit, but it's just not what I think people really wanted from the band. It's also like, it's a pretty long album, considering it's not a double album, but it's still a long album.
And it's another album where they recorded a like shit ton of songs that didn't make it on the album.
Yeah.
And then a lot of those songs showed up on Machina too, which we'll talk about in a minute, because I have thoughts.
I'm curious to your thoughts about that.
Yeah.
So basically what happens is they tour a door, but they do a handful, a 17-day, 15-city charity North American tour. All told, the band donated $2.8 million to charity. Entirely, 100% of the tickets went to sales of local charity organizations, which is awesome.
That's good.
It's super nice of them.
I like that.
Right?
Yeah.
So now we are at 1999. The band surprises fans by reuniting with a rehabilitated Jimmy Chamberlin for a brief tour dubbed The Arising, which showcased both new and classic material. The lineup was short-lived, however, and the band announced the departure of Darcy Wretzky in September of 99 during work on the album for Machina, The Machines of God. No one really knows why Darcy left the band or was shown the door or whatever, but it seems as though physical, mental, just kind of wear on her from being in this band for as long as it was. And quite frankly, it seems, at least from her perspective, that Jimmy Chamberlin was given years to get over his problems. She was given 3 months, and they were like, you got 3 months to get your shit together, and if you don't, you're out of the band. And that's kind of what happened. They fill her slot in the band with former Hole bassist Melissa Oftemar, who was recruited for the Sacred and Profane tour in support of the album and appeared in the videos accompanying its release. We see her in the video for The Everlasting Gaze. I kind of feel bad for Melissa Oftemar. She's a great bassist. She's awesome. And she just like, it's this like shitty, like it just sucks for her. But
it's like the start of Billy Corgan, like using bassist. Cause I think he did the same thing with Swan too. He pulled all these really good musicians together and then just kind of like did his own thing and got mad at them for not doing what he wanted them to do.
Yeah, it is disappointing that he doesn't seem to really recognize how important a cohesion is to the fans. Like he thinks that it's just about the music itself. And that I think is the significant disconnect that leads to their downfall in a lot of ways. Do you know what I mean? Like it's one of those things where like it's like when showrunners think cast members can come and go, for instance.
Yeah.
And viewers are like, yeah, no, not so much. Like I'm invested in these people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like there is a cohesion to the family of a band, you know, and like it, you know, you make beautiful music together. Like that's the whole point of it. And if there is that sort of people coming in and out, like a revolving door of just like new people, I feel like things sort of don't feel the same. And if it feels like, you know, if Billy Corgan were a showrunner, he'd be the person who puts his name on every episode, even though he didn't write it.
Yes,
but in Billy's case, he did write every episode in a way where it's like, maybe let someone else like have a shot at this because like,
yeah,
you know, want to hear something different.
That's a really astute way of putting it. It does feel like Billy Corgan would put his name on every episode. I listen, I don't necessarily, I'm sure you feel similar to me. I don't necessarily have a problem with that if you have done that. Like if you've put the work in and you feel as though your name should be on it, then so be it. All that being said, Darcy is shown the door. And Machina comes out and it kind of flops. It doesn't do very well. This is the moment when they fulfilled their contract is the other thing that should be said, right? So they've done, they have fulfilled the amount of albums they need to with Virgin, which was always kind of the point, it feels like, to some degree or another. And Machina, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on Machina, because I know that you like it a little bit more than I do.
Yes.
You know, to me, and then I obviously want to hear what you think of it. I it feels a little bit like the album They Think We Want.
Yeah.
As opposed to perhaps one that they're as passionate about.
I think the problem to me with the album is just that it's a concept album, but like actually a concept album.
Yes.
In a way where it's like, okay, well, like maybe I don't need a through line for like all of this stuff. And you can just like make good music and not have it all have to be like thematically similar, you know? Yeah.
Yep.
Because it's like, don't get me wrong, I love a good concept album, but I think it's just, again, not really what people wanted. And I know he likes to say, Billy Corgan likes to say that Melancholy is a concept album, but it's really not. Like, it's like disparate songs that are all just like on an album together, which is cool. Again, that's why I love it. But for Machina, being a concept album about like this like you know, the Glass family or whatever. That, like, I can't remember exactly what the story is.
It's
I tried so hard to pay attention to it, and I was like, I don't understand what this is. I just want to hear good music. But it's like, there are some songs in the album that I really like a lot. Like, Stand Inside Your Love, I think, is a great song. Everlasting Gaze is, like, is good.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, Try, also a great song.
There are some very good songs on it. I don't mean to suggest that there aren't. I think it's just, and this is sort of, I think that, just to kind of wrap this up, and then we'll kind of come back to this a little bit. But basically, May 23rd, 2000, Billy Corgan announces the band is breaking up. The group's final album before the breakup is Machina 2, The Friends and Enemies of Modern Music. That's the name of the album, everybody. Mm-hmm. Talk about subtlety. It's released in September of 2000 in a limited pressing on vinyl with the permission and instructions for free distribution on the internet by fans. Only 25 copies were cut. It's gone viral for whatever that's worth. You can get it if you want it. It's out there. Originally, the band asked Virgin to offer Machina 2 as a free download to anyone who bought Machina, but the record label declined. Sure. And then they played a final show December 2000 at the Cabaret Metro in Chicago, which was where it all started, which was their first performance. So the thing about Machina to me is that it feels a little bit like... it feels like every band comes to a point, sort of, where they have to decide, do we want to keep doing what we're doing, or do we want to try to break that mold a little bit and zig where everybody thinks we're going to zag?
Right.
And some bands are able to successfully do that. Your Kid A's, your Sea Changes, your whatever the case might be, of bands that are able to sort
two
of...
Two great albums, by the way.
Tremendous.
Two albums. Of my favorite albums.
They're fucking great. I love them both. Yeah. But, you know, I look at Machina like I look at Beck's Wero, where it's like he just kind of made an album that he feels like people want him to make now. And Machina just feels a little bit like it's going through the motions at times.
That is such a good music dork like comparison. Because when Wero came out, I was so like, oh my God, yes, new Beck. And I listened to it and I was like, what is this? Like, this is not what I want at all. I hate this album. And I still honestly don't like it.
I don't like it.
But for Machina, I think it was a little bit of the same. But then when I downloaded Machina 2, I like Machina 2 so much more than Machina 1 because there's so many better songs on it. It has like a rougher sound to it, you know? Because obviously it's mostly unfinished. Yeah. Which is another tragedy of the song or the album, because I think also like Billy wanted Machina to be a double album again. And Virgin was like, fuck no, you don't make any money anymore. You can't do that. So that's why they released it for free, because they're like, well, shit, what are we going to do with this? And they just like gave it out, which for me, you know, a little miscreant in the internet, I was like, yes, give me the album for free. And it was like, I just like, there's so many good songs on it and it's so beautiful. And it's like that the fuzziness of it kind of like lends itself to the charm of it in a way. And it kind of like what I wanted Machina 1 to be, but Machina 1 was so polished and like this like really glossy hard rock kind of way that I just like don't really like.
I think that's part of why Machina didn't work as well, is that, I mean, there's a bunch of things working against the Smashing Pumpkins at this point. So on some level, it would have taken a miracle for this thing to work for them. First of all, pop music is obviously just blowing up the airwaves. So like people are kind of done with this version of alt rock. And then... you know, as you said, very polished, very sort of like, I mean, the first lyric on the album is Billy screaming, "You know, I'm not dead." Like it's just an attempt so boldly to be like, please don't bury me. I'm not dead yet. It's kind of sad.
Because like, and it's sad too, because it felt like they were trying to also kind of like veer almost into like the new metal sensibilities in some of the songs in a way where I was like, no, that's not what I want. Like, again, I want more like melancholy Siamese Dream. Mm-hmm. Like, and not that I want them to do the same things forever, but I think it's like one of the things that I love about, you know, Kid A and Sea Change was that it was so different than what came before and unlike anything else I'd also heard before. And it felt like Machina sounded like something I could just get off of, like, you know, whatever random shitty hard rock band was around at the time. It just felt very like middle of the road of that kind of music.
Totally. I, you know, it's funny. as you were talking there, I keep thinking that like Billy got his hand forced into making a sea change in a Kid A with a door. It's not what he wanted to do. He wanted to keep making melancholies is the impression that I get. But, you know, obviously with Jimmy's overdose and or his drug addiction, what have you, he got forced into being pushed into a lane. And quite frankly, I think a door is one of the best sort of left turns a band has done. It's just not what we wanted at that moment from them. And then this hard pivot backwards, back towards the mainstream with Machina, chasing your Slipknots and your Korns at the time is not what we wanted.
And I think that's what I mean, because I think it's like from Melancholy to a door, I was like, okay, cool, I'm on board for this. This is like a different lane that I wasn't expecting. But then from a door to Machina, I was like, wait, this just sounds bad. Like, I just don't like this. Like, this is just like boring, like Nickelback. You know, it's like better Nickelback to me at the time. And again, there are a handful of songs on it that I like a lot. And actually, one of my favorite songs on Machina too, apparently, yeah, the song Home is such a beautiful song. But apparently it was supposed to, like the legend goes that it was supposed to be the lead single on Adore. And I think Virgin was all ready to like make this a lead single, and Billy got pissed and he pulled it off the album. And of course, that to me is like, that's something that Billy Corgan is going to fucking do. But it's like such a good song. And it sounds like it would fit right in on that album.
It's really funny. It's, you know, I did a, this is going to sound off topic, but I swear it makes sense. I did an episode of another podcast, You're Missing Out, where they talk about the various movies that are put into the National Registry historical registry, what have you. And I did it on Sunset Boulevard. And one of the things about Sunset Boulevard that really hits home for me is this idea that Hollywood doesn't run on money, it runs on relevancy. And that idea that when you become quote unquote irrelevant, that idea that like when people don't care about you as much, that's what kills you. Like that's the thing that drives you crazy. We're seeing it with the current occupant of the Oval Office as well, where this idea of relevancy, this idea of like you have to pay attention to me, eats away at people when they find themselves at a certain level of fame. And Billy Corgan seems like the type of person who got a taste for it. And it's like, you're going to have to drag me off the fucking stage. And that's a bummer because, you know.
I think it almost feels like the common denominator of the Smashing Pumpkins sort of falling apart and their music not being as good is Billy Corgan. And it's like, I know that sounds kind of harsh, but I think it's like after Machina, you know, obviously they broke up or whatever. And then they kind of came back 12 years later with Oceana.
Oceana.
I was so excited and I listened to an album and I was just like, this is just, if Adore to Machina was a zag when I think he should have zigged, Oceana was just like a wet fart. I was so disappointed.
Between Oceana and Machina is an album called Zeitgeist. You remember that one?
No. Again, yeah. I know I listened to it and I don't remember it.
There is something I would argue that the Smashing Pumpkins career post Machina or Machina 2 can basically be summed up in that meme that was floating around of Billy sitting on that little fucking in a theme park, sitting on this
he's making the face, right?
He's making this stink face. He's angry. He doesn't want to be there. And it's just, and it obviously caught fire because he's sort of a gigantic person in this tiny little kid's train. But it's also just, it's similar to the Cure, Get In Losers, We're Gonna Go Crying. Like there's just something about him just not understanding that he just doesn't matter anymore.
Which, and it's so sad too, because like he really does matter. I think it's just like, he thinks that what he's making is so thoughtful and these concept albums are so big and like mind provoking. And for me, I'm just like, this music just doesn't sound good. Like I'm totally cool if you want to make concept albums as long as they sound sonically pleasing. Shit, man. Like I love Tommy. Great album. Concept album. It's great.
I will say there are probably more whiffs than home runs when it comes to concept albums because it's a tough needle to thread. And you know, I think that it works in the case of Melancholy because to your point, you know, it's the whole like, you know, sunrise, sunset, yin and yang, sort of that like night
dawn and
day,
dusk, dawn like and all this sort of,
yeah. Like there is something nice to that. And it's a big umbrella with which to bake as many stories as you want underneath it. But to your point, when he goes full on with Machina, for instance, where like you could go down a rabbit hole on the internet trying to explain that album away, but it still doesn't make any fucking sense.
And like it doesn't, not that it has to make sense. It just, again, as long as the songs sound good, and the songs of Machina to me, like a lot of them just didn't sound good, and like it still bums me out. Like I was like, I wanted it to be good, and it wasn't to me what I wanted, you know, in a way that was different from how I felt about Adore.
I remember also feeling like, you know, so Melancholy comes out, obviously. I mean, it's probably my top three favorite albums of all time, if I'm being completely honest. And, you know, then Adore comes out. And Adore comes out. I'm 18 years old at this point. I'm 19 when Everlasting Gaze comes out. Like, I'm now perhaps aging out of the Smashing Pumpkins a little bit in terms of, like, being right in the lane for them or in the pocket for them. And then Everlasting Gaze, the video comes out. And did you watch the video by any chance recently?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I still have it, but one of my most played DVDs I used to own was like all of their music videos.
I have it on my shelf right over here. Yeah, it's the best. And this is a good opportunity. I want to talk about all their music videos here, but just to specifically talk about Everlasting Gaze, it comes out December 9th, 1999. It's directed by Jonas Åkerlund, who has gone on to have quite an illustrious music video career, still making music videos with Lady Gaga. He did Telephone, the Lady Gaga Beyonce video.
Unfamiliar.
Unfamiliar with that one?
Yeah, I don't know. Beyonce.
Yeah, okay. Sure. And I think it's a good video. I think it's an interesting video. I like the metatextual kind of, halfway through the video, you get the cuts to actual digital video of the sort of the making of the video. And it's like trying to sort of deconstruct itself a little bit, which is kind of cool.
It felt very of the late 90s.
Yes.
Like it is like green toned. It's very
the ground is like,
everyone's wearing black. There's like people wearing like those like tank tops, but not really tank tops, but they're super form fitting and they're made of like latex.
Yeah.
People with like blue hair, you know, it's like, it's like everyone feels like they're in the Matrix.
Everyone absolutely feels like they're in the Matrix. The floor is a shade of green that we basically is now green screen. So I always kept thinking like, is something going to happen to the floor to make it turn into something? It's a very strange, aesthetic that kind of had a moment, to your point, in the late 90s. You've got Melissa Auftemar in this very form-fitted white leather outfit where like part of her boob is showing for no particular reason other than, I guess, because she's attractive. And it's just sort of like, and Billy's in this oddly leather form-fitting dress onesie sort of thing that I can't, it's very strange. But it's a cool video. The song, just to give our
you know, I'm not dead.
Billy said that this song has, quote unquote, a lot to do with spirituality and trying to find my place in the universe and sort of humbly accepting limitations and the things that I've been graced with. It's more of a humanistic worldview. I'm not writing anymore for the tortured teen, both me and whoever's listening. I'm writing with the idea that everybody's experiencing these things all the time. And even if you're not experiencing them personally, they're affected by them. You can live in the street and write about the garbage, or you can try to get up a little higher and look down and try to see the bigger picture. I don't know what any of that means, but
that's what that means. That means that is nonsense. One of my favorite parts of the music video, because I watched it earlier, one of like the top YouTube comments was back when the band could afford to destroy their gear. And I was like, oh God, that's so mean.
brutal assessment. There's also this song. So, and this Smashing Pumpkins have a tendency to do this. Billy has a tendency to do this where he'll kind of break form and the whole song will just drop out and he'll just recite angry poetry at you because that's what he does. As he does in this song where he says, We all want to hold in the everlasting gaze, enchanted in the rapture of his sentimental sway, but underneath the wheels lies the skull of every cog, the fickle fascination of an everlasting god. You know I'm not dead. I don't know what any of that means. It sounds interesting. It sounds like cool and big and interesting.
Yeah.
But it feels hollow.
Yeah, well, because it's a fucking concept album. It's going to be like and related to like whatever the concept is. It's like why I hated it. I was just like, this is such nonsense. Yeah. Like, I think of like my, we'll get into our favorite Smashing Pumpkins song. But my favorite Pumpkin songs are always the ones that were so like universal about like growing up or like whatever, but also that just sounded good. Music that sounded nice.
It really kind of comes down to one word for me, which is melody. Like he's a really beautiful writer of music and of lyrics. And when those things are all speaking to each other, they make really beautiful music. When he's angry and gnashing his teeth at something that it just rings a little false for me at times.
Yeah, because it felt like I'm not too familiar with what they're making musically right now. I tried to listen to like a new song earlier and I just couldn't get through it. But it just felt like he got so jaded and it kind of bled into the music in a way. You know, where he was like getting angry at the listener for not getting it. And I think that's when I started to tune out, where I was like in parts of Machina where I was like, okay, now you're just like, you're talking literal nonsense right now. Like, get back to like where's the music, bud? You know?
Play the hits. Yeah.
Yeah, play the hits. Play Landslide. Yeah.
Play someone else's hit. Yeah, it's no, I agree with you. It's a slippery slope. And you know, this is also at a totally different time in music. Like I imagine that we have some listeners, maybe, hopefully, that are on the younger side. And you know, it's hard to really convey to people what music was like, you know, quite frankly, pre-Napster, you know, before the digital revolution to music. Music was not just, you know, unbelievably lucrative, but it was also just, it almost didn't feel as sort of tactile. The idea that like when a single came out, you had to be like next to a radio to hear it. Like these ideas now are so foreign because music is immediately accessible to you. It makes it that much more passionate, you know?
And especially like, cause I think we're of similar generation, even though I am much, much younger than you.
21. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like very young. I'm a fetus, but like, you know, we were of the same age where it's like, you know, you would go to school or whatever you were doing. And you had, if you had a CD player, I had a CD player. Maybe you had like a Betamax player. I don't know what you guys had back then.
I had a CD player, you son of a bitch.
But like you would carry like maybe 1 to 2 CDs with you. Cause that's like the most you could carry. Yeah. And so like you will listen to those albums over and over again. And for me, like that was like the Smashing Pumpkins and Radiohead and Beck were like those were the musical acts that I was like getting really into. And so like it's so interesting now because like you would hear a song and you're like, I don't like this, and you would just move on with your day. But we would have to buy the albums to hear the songs. And if we didn't like it, what are you supposed to do? Now you own it. You know,
and it's and like a lot of money for it too, by the way. Like,
and so I think we would like, and we're of the generation where we would give albums more shots because now we have paid upwards of $20 for them to own them. And so it's just, it was so different back then. Like you said too, like you would buy a single. Like I remember buying singles on cassettes.
Yeah.
And like, just like what a world, you know, like we're like in the dark ages.
It's funny you say that. Because as you were talking about like having that, you know, you'd have a handful of CDs with you. If you were lucky, you could carry like 3 or 4 of them in your backpack or whatever. There's a generation that will never know the sheer aggravation of a skipping CD in a Discman.
Oh, man. Especially when it's like one of your favorite songs, too. I remember I went through like 2 copies of Wilco's Yankee Hotel Foxtrot because I'm a hipster asshole. But I think it's because I just listened to that album so many times. And I would take it from my car to my CD player. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't have a CD player in my car. I had like the tape deck that you would hook up to the CD player. Mm-hmm. And then also like I think children these days probably don't realize like how revolutionary like electronic shock protection was. Because before that, when you had a CD player and didn't have that, you heard those skips and it would scratch your CD.
I can't articulate for our listeners who maybe don't know what we're talking about, that when you're stuck on a subway or you're stuck on a bus,
yeah,
and you know you've got a half hour till you get home, and you just really want to listen to this fucking song, and it's just skipping,
it just sucks.
It's just and it's. I remember when I got my first iPod, which was probably in my first or second year, first year of university. It was a fucking game changer. It literally changed my entire life that I never had to hear a skipping CD again.
Yeah,
the Case Logic cases that you would put your CDs in, which you'd slide them in and out, and you'd scratch the fuck out of them by sliding them in and out of these things. It was just a nightmare.
That was the other, the game changer too. Like when they had the little 10-pack book, and I would have that in my backpack. Mm-hmm. But it was you're curating your music for the week. You're like, ooh, I'm gonna swap in some new albums this week. What am I gonna pick? And then you had the fucking stupid visor in your car, And you would just another game changer, and I feel like we were living through history every day, but it's we could be able to burn mix CDs.
Oh my God.
And how cool that was.
Huge.
Yeah.
I also just, as is the case, I'm sure, with people still to a certain degree, but, I remember either flipping through or having a girl flip through my CD case and thinking, this is a big fucking deal. What's in there? This is defining you as a person. It was a very big deal. I don't know. But all of this is just to say that, it was just a different time in music. And I think that, Billy couldn't exist today in music.
No.
I mean, there are very few artists that can exist today because of how sort of, I don't know. It does feel like, what does it mean to be a big music artist right now? It feels very temporal to me. I don't, but I'm older. So, what do I know?
But I think too, and to your point, it was just with music videos and CDs, it just felt like people were, back in my day, people paid more attention to music. And so it really did feel especially for Tonight Tonight, you see that music video and you're like, what is this song? I need to buy this album.
Yeah.
But these days it's you hear, WAP by Cardi B and Meg Thee Stallion. You're like, I'll buy this single, but there is no album to buy anymore. It feels like everything these days is just singles.
No, I absolutely agree with you. It's so in terms of the Smashing Pumpkins videos, because I do think that it's worth talking about for a second here, because I do feel like this was a time when music videos were, you had MTV, you had TRL, you had, music videos played on loop.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And their music videos were pretty groundbreaking at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I still think they're pretty groundbreaking. And some of the artists, some of their directors, Dayton and Ferris did the Tonight Tonight video, which is, I think, one of the best music videos ever made.
Of all time.
It's phenomenal.
And
Dayton and Ferris, I believe, did the video for Today as well. I do think that there were a lot of really interesting filmmakers that came out of their music videos. Disarm is a beautiful music video. I think that, they really kind of broke ground with their music videos in an accessible way. You know what I mean? I can sit here and talk to you about how much I love Bjork and Radiohead's music videos, and Lord knows someday I'm sure I will. But you know, Michel Gondry, Spike Jonze, Chris Cunningham, these are very different filmmakers. You know, the video for 1979 feels like a moment. Feels like it captured kids in that.
And I think that's sort of my point too, where it's like you would use your music video to get across the tone of the song. Yeah. And I feel like I think that still happens. I just don't feel like music videos are as big as they used to be. But it's like the music video for like 1979 defines what the theme of 1979 is in a way that makes me love the song even more. You know, like Tonight is just this big, otherworldly, literally like epic song, and the music video is exactly that. Mm-hmm. And so I just don't think that music does that anymore. Where like I think only in like rap do like Beyonce and like Kendrick Lamar like make these awesome, big, epic music videos. It just feels like it just doesn't really happen anymore, except for like these super huge people.
Yeah. It feels like it's kind of Lemonade or Bust now a little bit. You know what I mean? Like if you can, you know, I don't want to say elevate because we obviously both love music videos, but just sort of that idea of taking it to another level, production wise and otherwise, like it's an enormous thing. It's an enormous undertaking. Whereas back in the day, you know, you mentioned the sort of the synergy of the music video for 1979 and the song. I mean, that is sort of a perfect example of they are now one. Like those two things have blended together. And now when I hear that song, it conjures up the images of those kids in that music video so perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, similarly with Tonight, which again, very different aesthetic, very different tone, but those things sort of speaking to each other is really rare. You know,
and I was like of the right age too as a teenager. I was just doing like the Italian like, hey yo, putting my fingers up in the air, I'm making a point here. But it's like I was of the age at the time where it's like, you know, I would drive around with my friends, we would listen to the Smashing Pumpkins, just like driving aimlessly around our boring ass suburban town. Mm-hmm. Like I would get up into my like spaceship and fly off into the moon, like in Tonight. Mm-hmm. Like I would do those things.
Yeah.
But it's just like it encapsulates the song so well. And like the mid-90s were just like it for music videos. Like that was like the time. Like Foo Fighters, like Nirvana before Kurt Cobain killed himself. Those were the thing. And it was so big. And it bums me out that it's just not as, because even as a kid, I was like, I wanted to get into like writing music videos because I was like, how do I do that? And it's like just not a thing that happens anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they still make them, but I agree with you. It's I mean, I think the biggest problem is that MTV doesn't show them, right? So it's just the vehicle for music videos now is purely online, which means that the music video needs to be either, you know, unbelievably audacious, like, you know, a Cardi B song, which more power to her.
Great
music videos. Or it needs to be like super artsy, esoteric, indie, whatever the case might be, where like, you know, Spike Jonze decides he wants to do another music video or whoever, and they do something that's really interesting. But to your point,
it's like Paul Thomas Anderson is like best friends with Haim, which is amazing, but it's also like, man.
Plus, like, I love Haim. I love Paul Thomas Anderson. I'm not sure that together they're necessarily breaking new ground. Like, their music videos are fine, but like,
it's always just them like walking around, and I'm like, wait, you have these two amazing artistic forces, and they come together, and it's just them like walking down Ventura Boulevard, and I'm like, wait, what?
It's like, listen, Paul, I love Cantors too. Yeah, Cantors is great. But like, what are we doing? You just decided to put Danielle behind the deli counter and just filmed her singing a song?
No, like put Haim in like in Phantom Thread. That's what I want to see.
Exactly. Well, do you want to, let's talk about our top 10 Smashing Pumpkins songs.
Yeah.
You want to alternate and start from the bottom and work our way up? I have like 11-ish. So, you said you had a little more than that. Do you want to do your bottom however many until you get to 11?
You want me to start at the bottom and go up?
We'll
I think bottom would probably be... I couldn't decide between Disarm or Soma.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
Two songs that I really like a lot. I think Disarm is also like the sound of the 90s to me.
Yeah.
You know, like that and like Cranberries, like fucking like
Linger.
Well, not no Dreams.
Oh, Dreams. Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, it's like They're both songs that I can imagine like Claire Danes running down the street in flannel too, you know. You know exactly.
Yeah, I see it in my dreams every night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like crying because Jordan Catalano can't read.
Okay. All right. So is that your, what number is that for you?
I would say that's like 10 and 11.
Okay. So I'm going to cheat a little bit just out of the gate and just say that, cause I wanted to kind of acknowledge how great their covers are. I really love, My Blue Heaven, Landslide, A Night Like This, Dancing in the Moonlight. You know, those are four phenomenal covers, and I kind of wanted to put them in their own box and just say like, I love those songs, but they're not their songs. So I, you know, it doesn't seem fair to say that would be my favorite. So at number 11, I have the Lost Highway track, which I remember hearing for the first time whenever it was and thinking like, oh fuck, like this is them doing like Marilyn Manson, Nine Inch Nails now. Like they're pivoting into that world. And they're surrounded by those bands on the Lost Highway soundtrack. So it made sense. But it was really sort of the moment when I was like, well, they're not the band that I think they are anymore, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it was like an eye opening thing. No pun intended.
It was the first time I also like realized what a drum machine was. Cause I was like, wait, that's not a real person playing the drums, is it?
Right. at number 10, I have, Said Sadly.
Okay.
Which I really love. It is a B-side off of Tonight, I believe, on the Airplane Flies High. I love it because Billy doesn't sing on it. It's Darcy and James. And it's one of the very rare opportunities that he lets them fucking sing. Lead on something, even though I guess they all sing on Farewell and Goodnight at the end of Melancholy. But it's just a really pretty song. Also, James and Darcy had a relationship of some sort. So the song really kind of encapsulates, I think, that. It's just a really pretty song that feels a little bit sort of like I wanted to acknowledge that lane that didn't get a lot of acknowledgement in its moment. So, what's your number nine?
My number nine is Ava Adore.
Nice.
Because it's just like such a fun song. And I love the music video. Perfectly encapsulates like what the song is, just like dark goth rock, you know. And like the music video is so cool. What's the, like the line in the song? It's you that I adore. I'll always be your whore. And of course, I'm like 15 listening to that song, and I'm like, yeah, like I'll always be your whore.
And it's like something about like car crashes too. Like it's a lot of like a lot of weird, sort of violent mythology, sort of lyric content. It's a weird fucking song. It's also weird. It's a weird song because like you knew you were listening to an album that was at odds with itself when it opens with To Sheila, which is a very sweet piano ballad.
Yeah,
then there's like a 15 second quiet because they're like, we're now about to go into a fucking crazy song about whores and car crashes. And then it goes into Perfect. Like those three songs encapsulate the problems that album has with itself. But
yeah, it's just such a, I think that's probably why I like it. It's because it was such a weird song. And like the beginning of like the womp, 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 womp. I'm like, what is like, this is so different than what I was expecting. But like, I like it, you know?
Yeah, I was into it. Yeah. At number nine, I have Soma, which I love.
That song. Yeah.
I afternoons playing NHL hockey on my Sega Genesis listening to Soma. Very much a moment for me. They're one of those bands that I don't know about you, but I'm not a big fan of long songs generally. I find them kind of trying. This is one of those bands that they can do an 8-minute song and I'm in.
Yeah.
Agreed. And Soma is one of those songs. Yeah. What's your number?
Number eight, I have Home from Machina 2.
Nice.
Because it's just like, again, it's such a beautiful song. And it's like sonically so much what I wanted more of from Machina. you know? And it's like, because yep. it's rocky, it's fuzzy, it's got like that weird chunky sound to it. And I wish I could have heard the version that was supposed to be on a door. I mean, but maybe not though, because I think the version might have been more produced, which is maybe not what I like about this song. But it's just a beautiful song, and I really like it a lot.
It's funny as you say that. I was thinking about, you know, there aren't a lot of bands that can do sort of high end production and also do Stripped Away and like actually make it work within the confines of what we think they're allowed to do, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And they are one of those bands, to your point, where like they can do some like weird mono shitty, you know, scrappy song. And then they can also do something gigantic with like, you know, massive strings and like all that sort of shit. So it's
I think with Machina too, it wasn't really their choice because these songs were also unfinished and they just like pushed them out on the internet because they were pissed at their record label, which again, relatable, you know,
fair point.
Yeah.
At number eight, I have The Boy, also from Airplane Flies High, which is one of the B-sides on the 1979 disc. You know, I put a couple of these Airplane Flies High on here because I felt like they don't get a lot of love. And I also have some bigger singles near the top. So that is what it is. But I don't know. It's a punchy, fun song. I also kind of love, and I'm sure you notice this too, that the way that they bunch the songs together under each single feel akin to the single that they're a part of.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So like... Yep. These songs evoke the feeling of 1979 or Tonight or Zero. So that's also really cool that it kind
and
of
what other band has ever done I that, know, you know? It's like, it's so cool.
I know.
But also that also just shows how many songs they had that they could do that. It's like, oh, wow. Yeah. Maybe that's a problem. Yeah.
what's your number? Are you seven? I think, are we at seven? I think
we're at seven. My seven is Perfect from Adore. Because again, it's like, the sequelness to 1979, which is on this list somewhere, I'm not going to tell you where, but it is like it something about that song is just so beautiful and melodically so pleasing to me. But then the music video being a sequel to the music video for 1979, which is one of my favorite music videos of all time, I thought was really, and like the song is just really like sad, and like there's a somberness to it, you know, that it makes you feel like you're growing up in a sad way.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting, you know, making that allusion to the sort of filmmaking component of the 1979 music video and this music video for Perfect, where they're doing a bunch of stuff that I still don't really know how they did. I still don't know how they got those toilet paper shots where they threw the toilet and the camera's with the rolls of toilet paper.
There's a making of somewhere. I think I saw how they did it. Okay, but it's like, it's a really cool, like they're good music videos.
They're really good music videos and they're like lo-fi, but they feel like you're really there. You know, it's, as I'm sure you know, whenever you're filming or writing, when as a writer, you sit down and write a scene that takes place in a club or in a concert, in your brain, you're like, well, this is going to suck. Cause like, it's never going to feel like it feels like to be there. And these two music videos actually do make you feel like you're with these kids and that you're really a part of what's going on.
Yeah. So
that's cool. At number seven, I have Daphne Descends from Adore, which I don't know. Maybe it's because I just love the title, but there's just something very... it comes back to sort of what we were talking about with the production of Adore. There's this kind of crunchiness and weirdness and sort of noise, beautiful kind of noise that's always in the periphery of every song. And this song's just... I think there's something about when Billy picks a name or tells a story about a person and really kind of personifies it, it just really comes to life for me personally. I don't quite know why that is, but it's like, I feel like I know Daphne, and it's a really great song. So
agreed.
What's your number six?
Stand Inside Your Love. Like, I just love that song. It's just like, it was like the song that I wanted more of on Machina.
Yes.
Cause it's just like that sort of like loud rock vibe.
Yeah.
But didn't sound as new metal-y. It's also just such a sad, like, it is also a whiny song. It's almost like not a, you know, like a,
yes,
an anthem for like sad boys who aren't dating anybody. Like who wouldn't be the one you love? who wouldn't stand inside your love, you know? That sort of like friend zone-y thing. Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's a definite, I mean, that's you could argue is
all their songs.
A current underneath every Smashing Pumpkin song of just like, there's a lot of, I don't like necessarily saying whiny, but there's definitely a lot of, what's the best way to put this? Not self-loathing, but just sort of like a lot of navel gazing, a lot of like, but why not me? Why can't you love me?
Yeah.
It's a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Number six, I have Lily, My One and Only.
Good song.
It's a really good song about stalking.
Yeah. Again, another undercurrent for some of these other songs too.
Yeah. There's something very, again, it's, and I'm sure maybe this is a through line through most of the songs that I really love of theirs, but like, I just love a good storytelling, like a good storyteller. And Billy can be a really great storyteller. Mm-hmm. So I really love that song. What's your number? Are you five? Are we at five?
Yeah. My five, you know, I'm going to reorder some of these around. I'm going to say, oops,
go for it.
Try, but the version on Machina 2.
Okay.
Yes. Not the one that was on Machina 1. The version on Machina 2 is, again, it's like that much more raw. I think it's like an alt version of the song.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's something about it. Like, I just like the lyrics more, and I just like the song more than the more produced version of it.
Totally fair.
Because it's just like a sad song, and there's like this like weird kind of fuzzy, like synthesizer noise in the alt version that I like more than the other version. It's a pretty song.
It's a very pretty song. It's a lovely song. At number five, I have Today, which, mm-hmm. you know, as a kid who loved movies and music, you know, this album comes out in, you know, 93 or so. This was one of the first moments when I would play a song and just fuck around with a camera.
Yeah.
And I loved sort of the quiet to loud that they do quite a bit, where, like, you know, they start with the tinkling of something and then like
coming
like coming with some fucking crazy. It's a fucking great hooky song, and it's a testament that you could see this being a one hit wonder song. Like, you could see this being one of those just like big fat huge fucking singles from a band that never does anything again, and they were able to keep it up. So
yeah.
What's your four?
Today is my number four. For all the reasons you said. Yeah, it's just like, it's such a pretty song, even though the lyrics are so sad. I think that's also a thing I like about it, is like the juxtaposition of the lyrics with the sound of it, where it is just like, it is such a hot and cold sort of like feeling that you get from it. It's just such a pretty song, and it, you know, it makes you feel good until you hear those lyrics about this red ribbon scars, and you're like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it's at number four, I have Tonight.
Heard of it.
you know, again, this was sort of one of those albums for me anyway, and one of those songs that announces itself.
Yeah.
You know, this is you got a little bit of instrumentation at the very top of this album for this, you know, the instrumental song Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, but this is the first song, and it just comes in with just big fucking strings and just the biggest sort of the epicness of this song that basically says, this is the thesis statement. We're going big. It's going to be huge. It's going to be just like nothing you've heard before, and buckle up for a hell of a ride. And that's so exciting.
It is. You're right.
What's your number three?
Through the Eyes of Ruby is my number three.
Great.
Which is like, oh my God. I listened. It's probably like, aside from my number one and two songs, or like, that's like the third song I've probably listened to the most off of Melon, like, or of any Smashing Pumpkin song, even though it is longer, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's 7 minutes, 38 seconds long. And I used to listen to it all the fucking time. It's another one of those songs that like starts off and then gets loud as shit, and then just sort of like not meanders, but like it meanders in a really pretty way, you know? Mm-hmm. And then it gets back into the loud shit, and it's just like exactly what I want from a Smashing Pumpkin song. It hits all the notes, like nonsense lyrics that sound pretty. like pretty instruments, you know, like beautiful sounds.
Yeah.
It's just, I love it. It's just such a good song.
Yeah. It's, you know, not to harken back to Tonight and the music video for it, but for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's essentially a recreation of the Millet movie,
Trip to the Moon.
But when you see them all standing on clouds, wearing old-timey clothes, playing these old-timey instruments, and you're just sort of like, it makes me think of what you were just saying about Through the Eyes of Ruby, of like pretty instruments, this like just sort of like the grandiosity of what they're doing, and that they're embracing it for all of its kind of in all its glory. Like on some level, I'm sure that they had to acknowledge that what they were doing was perhaps a little bit silly, but at the same time, they're owning it. And it's just, it's superb. My number three is Disarm. You know, it is to your point, a quintessential 90s song that every, you know, teenage girl is running through the streets wearing flannel while it plays.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's also one of those, music videos that I remember it really kind of imprinted me with sort of the aesthetic of it, which was these extreme close-ups on the faces of the band members with this rear projection of this other black and white footage that was done really kind of seamlessly. It's just a really beautiful music video.
Yeah.
I've always been really taken with it. But what's your number two?
My number two is Tonight. Again, for a lot of the same reasons you were saying, I think to me, it's like the pinnacle of like the Smashing Pumpkins in a way. Because it is like you were saying, it's like they put on those old-timey costumes, like stood on that cloud, and they looked ridiculous. But they had like, they looked like for the first time, like they were having fun. Yep. And like, it's just such a, that song is just so grandiose and just fucking huge. And it's also like, because like, I work out. And so I have like running songs on my workout playlist. Yeah. But it's like Tonight has been on like my running playlist for probably like 20 years. Like it's like one of those songs. It's just anytime I hear that song, I listen to it from front to back. Like regardless, like it's never a song I'll skip. It's never a song that I get tired of. It's like almost like There by Radiohead, where like I hear that song and I'm like, oh, I love this fucking song. Like Tonight is just such a good song.
There's also something about, and I don't know if you feel the same way that I do, but like there's something about the way that Billy pronounces certain words that also really works for me. And Tonight has the way he says the impossible is possible tonight.
Yeah.
That it's like stuck in his throat in a way that's just sort of, he has this very obviously kind of nasally crackly voice at times.
Yeah.
It's a great fucking song.
It's funny you say that too, because like the way that Billy pronounces things in songs in general, you know? Like I think of like zero. It's like emptiness is loneliness, and loneliness is God is empty, just like me.
There is. I mean, it's funny when you say like that specific instance, right? And even a little bit in we were talking earlier about Everlasting Gaze. There is something performative about what he's doing that makes me think, are you fucking with us a little bit, Billy? Like, is there a little bit of tongue in cheek in what you're doing? Do you know what I'm saying?
I hear you. Yeah. I don't think there is, but I think it's all straight. I think he's like, there isn't. It is all genuine.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. At number two, I have Stumbling, which, you know, it's a little song. That just for whatever reason, claiming her destiny with her feet in the stirrups. There's just a lot of really powerful stuff going on in that song. It's just a really, really, I guess the best way to put this is it perfectly personifies how intimate and small and beautifully poetic their songs can be.
Yeah.
I think that that's something that they don't get enough love for. I think that people understandably get swept away in all the stuff we're talking about with Tonight. And even all all the bullshit that comes with Smashing Pumpkins that makes them a band that people perhaps don't own their love of because of the silliness and the kind of, you know, the pompousness and all of this shit. They make a beautiful song like Stumbling that's under 3 minutes long, that's just about like getting trapped in circumstances and being a human being. And it's just him and a fucking acoustic guitar. It's just, I don't know. It just really.
And I think that's also one of the things about Adore that at the time turned me off to the album. Mm-hmm. And that I only, like, you know, years after it came out that I revisited and was like, oh, okay, this is what I like about it. Yep. Were those moments that were stripped down and quieter and more poetic, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's also, it's a mixture of, I'm just looking something up really quickly here,
yeah.
But it's a mixture of all those things that makes it, that, I don't know, that just makes them not feel like just another fucking band. I don't know how else to explain it other than to say that I feel like they don't get enough love because I think a lot of people think that they are just a band called Smashing Pumpkins from the 90s. Like, there were a grunge band named Smashing Pumpkins. Like, that in and of itself is just sort of almost silly.
But, and I think, you know, to your point too, that was what drew me to them, was they were doing something that nobody else was, or they were doing something that other people were doing in their own way.
Yes.
And only when they started to do it the way other people were doing it was when I started to tune out. Like with Machina was when it started to sound like everything else I'd already been hearing. Yes. And that was when I was kind of like, well, this isn't as much as, like, and obviously with their newer stuff too, it just sounds so bland and so just not what the Pumpkins were. And like, and not that I'm like, oh, I missed my old band. It's like, they didn't evolve. It felt like, it is kind of like, they just sort of like hit this note and they've been hitting the same note ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, it's, there were definitely moments that I've had. I guess in a weird way, I have a little bit of a similarity between my feelings about Tim Burton and Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah.
Which is that I keep sitting there thinking, maybe, like, I have more faith that Tim Burton can turn it around than I do the Smashing Pumpkins can. But like,
that makes one of us.
But anyway, putting that aside, I think you understand what I mean when I say that, like, they had many moments when I thought maybe they could pull it off. Maybe they could find relevancy again. There was a part of me that felt like maybe a solo career for Billy, where just like, he just owns his name. He owns it. But then he became William Corrigan for a while there. And then, I mean, it was just like, he just couldn't get out of his own fucking way.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, unfortunately, that's the beginning and the end of the band. I think we have the same number one, it seems.
1979? Yeah. I was trying to think of like a joke song that's really bad and I couldn't think of any. Yeah, no, 1979 is like, it's that is my number one. I've listened to that song probably upwards of thousands of times.
Same.
And like, the music video is so good. It is like everything about being a teenager, like just doing stupid shit with your friends, like going to like shitty house parties and like getting in fights with people. It's just like, yeah, it's just quintessentially what, like, when I hear that song, I just can't help but feel like I'm a teenager again. It's like one of the only songs that really does that to me, except for like, maybe a Death Cab for Cutie song or like the Postal Service.
Yeah, I mean, 1979 is just, it's a perfect song. It's a perfect, as you said, it's a perfect synergy of song and music video, but also just, it feels, it felt nostalgic in 95. Like, it has this jukeboxy quality, the way that it opens with the clicking of what feels like something that's stuck in a loop.
Yeah.
There's just like this idea of, I mean, literally there's the lyric June bug skipping like a stone with the headlights pointed at the dawn. Like, just that idea of being trapped in a vicious circle of some sort that you can't seem to get yourself out of. I mean, it's called 1979, which makes it nostalgic in and of itself, just based on that it came out in 95. But I just remember it had the perfect sort of mixture of hope and I don't want to say nihilism, but like the lyric, which I pulled up here, and I don't even care to shake these zipper blues, and I don't know just where our bones will rest, to dust, I guess, forgotten and absorbed into the earth below.
You didn't pronounce it right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
And we don't even care. Just where our bones will rest.
That is the more appropriate way to pronounce it. But I think you know what I mean. Like, it had this sort of, it had this like, we don't care. We're fucking kids.
Yeah.
Whatever, man. But then also, it still is like written from the perspective of someone who's writing a song about the year when they were a teenager, which is Billy in 79. Like, that idea of sort of, we're destined to be buried somewhere at some point.
But I think it's like that kind of timelessness of the song that's still, that is so appealing to me. It is like, it is so evocative of being a teen. Like, you think you're invincible. And, like, we don't care that we're going to die. Like, we're teens. Like, we're just going to fucking go up to this hill and, like, flip off the town. You know, it's like, it's that kind of shit that I'm just like, oh, that is exactly what being a teenager is like. Yep. Obviously, in, like, a first world country. But, like, you know, it's just like, what else are you going to do? You know, you go to the corner store. You, like, maybe you shoplift. You, like, you drive around with your dumb friends. You go to a party. And, like, that's all you do. You skinny dip, maybe. Like, it's just, it hits every single note of being a teen to me.
Yeah, it really does have that feeling of aimlessness is the wrong word, but, like, you're sort of at a certain age where you're not old enough to do the things that grown-ups do, but you're also not young enough to be happy just sitting watching television. So, like, there's this push and pull that comes with that, like, 15, 16, 17 years old, where you're just like, fuck you, mom, dad, but you're also like, I don't know what to do.
And then I think it's also like, it's not only that, but it's also the hubris that you think you know better than your parents.
Yes.
I think it's like that sort of feeling of being a teen where it's like, fuck you, mom and dad. Like, you don't know what it's like when you're like, your parents are like, yeah, we do.
We do.
Like, of course we do. Cause we were also teens one day. I think it's why, like, I love the song so much. Cause like, you think of Billy singing the song about being a teen, telling his younger self all of the shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's tapping into that, like, that teenage dream. To quote Katherine Perry.
Teenage Dream is the yin to 1979's Yang. I think that that's...
Yeah, they're like the same song. Yeah.
They're like the same song. They're basically saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. I don't think that, you know, that they ever made a better song in terms of just a perfect
And that's like where it's like... It's so funny that the sequel to the song is called Perfect. Because, like, it's not... Yeah. But it's like, it's still a good song.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, you know, the music video is also like so sad, but it's like everything about being a teen. And then it's like all the shitty stuff about being in your 20s. And it's like, oh, like, no,
it's a lot of like teen pregnancy and like, just, it's just a bummer.
They're all miserable. They're all like, their lives suck now because they still live in their shitty town. And it's like the inverse of like growing up in the suburbs. Like, some people just don't get out.
There's also something, I mean, it's pretty clear in terms of the, obviously these two music videos are talking to each other, but, you know, in 79, you've got Billy in the back seat of a car as sort of the narrator kind of all these antics. And then in Perfect, he's wearing a cowboy hat on a crane.
Yeah. He's like looking down on everything. Like, he knows better, you know? It's just such a weird, like, it's again, like, and I love the song. I do. And I love the video too, but it's so weird. Like, I almost wish they hadn't made the music video a sequel to 1979. But then I don't know if I would like the song as much because I wouldn't have as much of a connection to it.
That's the thing. I mean, it's also, I mean, musically, it speaks to 79 as well. Like, they both have that similar kind of wistful nostalgia, looking backwards kind of component to it that I think is pretty great. I mean, this is the thing where, you know, I do think that they're a band that I wish truthfully that Machina 2 had been the end. Like, if he had just put a fucking period on the end of it, and if he wanted to do other things, great. But he keeps trying to hump this name of this band to try to make more cash grabs and money off of it, which, listen, I get it, but it's just disappointing. It's just
unnecessary. It's sad to me too, because it's like, if they had ended with Machina 2, they would have gone out on a high. And it's like, I wouldn't frown every time I heard a new Pumpkin song, and I'd be like, what is this? This is the Smashing Pumpkins now? Oh.
It's I have a similar relationship with Weezer.
Yeah. Another band, like, that just should have stopped a long time ago.
So long ago. But it's one of those things where you know, it's the old adage, is it better to burn out than fade away? But I do think that, you know, their highs are so high, and I hold those albums up as just, I love them so much that, you know, if he needs to get together with the guys, which, by the way, I guess they did a show relatively recently and they look so old. It just makes me so sad. It's just like, I don't know, man. I just wish they'd stop, but that's where it is. But listen, I'm so glad you came on to talk about the Smashing Pumpkins with me.
Me? Frankly, I'm glad you had me. Yeah.
I wish I was honestly, there are a bunch of spoiler to our listeners. Kenny doesn't really like our music episodes. he just doesn't. I don't think that he I don't know what the best way to describe this is, but it's ultimately, I think, it doesn't fit into the same box as movies and television do in terms of deconstructing in the same way to him, which is totally fair, and that's his prerogative. But there are a bunch of like seismic moments in music in 99 that I definitely want to unpack with people. And this was one of them, which is, this is the beginning of the end of one of my favorite bands. Like, this was sort of where the period should have been in 99, you know, Darcy leaving the band, you know, and obviously this last album of note from them. So I'm just so happy that you wanted to come on and talk about it with me.
Of course. And also, like, what was the line in Garden State? Like, don't think of it as a period, think of it as an ellipsis. Because that's what it was, an ellipsis for 12 years. And then Zeitgeist came out.
Can I just say, though, talk about the perfect movie to point to in this regard, too, where it's like Garden State is a movie that feels like it was made in another planet. Like, honestly, feels like such a relic of a different time. And I don't even hate Garden State, just to be clear. It's just like, I've tried to watch it since, and I'm just like, wait, there was a time when this was allowed? Like, we were okay to this?
I remember having to, because it came out when I was in high school, and I had to drive downtown to downtown Atlanta to the Midtown Art Cinema to go to the Art House movie theater to go see it, because it wasn't playing anywhere else. To go see Garden State.
Which, by the way, now would be like an actual studio movie. Like, there's nothing indie about that movie now.
And I thought it was so profound. I was like, wow, Garden State is it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great soundtrack.
It's a great and by the way, as I said, I've tried to watch it over the years a little bit in bits and pieces, because like I can't really sit down to watch the whole thing. And Manic Pixie Dream Girl aside, which it is perhaps the most glaring version of, there is some stuff in it that's not bad. Like the not just the music, but like it's well made, it's well shot.
It's
like
beautiful. It's a beautiful movie.
It's a well made movie. It's just. Whew, there are some times in there where you're just like, so why are we screaming into the quarry? Just because?
Yeah.
Because life, man.
Yeah, man. Because we live in New Jersey. Duh. Wouldn't you if you lived in New Jersey?
But I hope that you'll come back. I would actually love to have you on for one of the episodes on a TV show. I don't know. We'll go off mic, because there's a bunch of TV shows that we're covering.
Great.
And when I say we, I mean me. Yeah, so we're currently redoing Sex and the City season 2, but there's going to be other shows down the road. And you know, as a TV writer, I think you know something about writing television.
Yeah, I watch a lot of cartoons. I do actually watch a lot of cartoons.
You heard it first, guys.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I really, really, really appreciate you coming on to talk about this. And, you know, I can't wait to have you back for something else.
Same. I'll be back.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. 1999, podcast like it. You want the podcast like it. 1999.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.